Call the meeting to order. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're going to start with some reports from folks from the ethanol industry, responding to some of the research that's been printed out of the university, and want to hear from people on what their perspectives are and the latest research that they have to present. So, Brad Nelson, are you here?
Yes, I am.
All right. If you could make your way to the table, that would be great.
I was wondering if I could distribute some brochures.
Absolutely. We'll have Charlie come down and pass out whatever you need. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nelson. Do you want to introduce yourself for the record, and then you can begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brad Nelson. I'm a Fremont County resident. I am a lifetime farmer in Fremont County. I am a member of the Glenville Ethanol Board, and appreciate the chance to come and talk to you about our industry today. First off, I'd like to congratulate you as members of the legislature for allowing groups like ours to have a chance to break into the fuel business. We together, farmers, government, and ethanol firms, have achieved the goal that we have set out to do: revitalize the rural parts of our state with new business, increased revenue for farmers, new employment in outstate Minnesota, and increased income for state and local governments. We have cleaned up our air and have not polluted our water. Even with increased traffic on our roads, our air is cleaner than it was 20 years ago, and we have not polluted our groundwater, much like other states that used MTBE in their fuel supply. And in Minnesota, we have saved 1 year's gasoline supply and counting with our 10% blend of fuel. The programs put in place in the early 90s to get the ethanol started have worked and paid back the state like no other program has ever done. Now the ethanol industry is closing in on 10% of the nation's fuel supply. It has been an interesting year, to say the least, with high gasoline prices, high corn prices, plants with financial problems, and many sources attacking ethanol from everywhere. To break into the fuel market has taken government mandates, which in some circles is sharply criticized. I look at it today as we are mandated out of 90% of the fuel market. Because of EPA rules, vehicle warranties, and around the country, lack of availability of even E10 until recently, let alone E85 or mid-level blends such as E20, E30, or E40, in first quarter of 2009, we estimate that we are at 90 to 95% E10 saturation in the nation. We have a renewable fuel standard of 36 billion gallons that cannot be realized because we have a government rule that contradicts the government law, i.e. the EPA regulatory cap of E10. If the blend wall is not moved to E15 or E20, cellulosic ethanol will not be realized, and corn ethanol production may very well crash. Everything we have all worked for will be down the tubes. As government leaders and farmers and ethanol producers, I don't think this is what we want. In 2008, the U.S. ethanol producers left more than $5 billion on the table because our product was under such financial duress. Today we have plants idled, not just nationally, but in the state, and others struggling to make ends meet. We have been attacked through many arenas about water usage, food and fuel, and even greenhouse gas emissions. We compete very well with many industries, including oil drilling and refining, in water usage. Corn prices have dropped over 50%, yet food prices remain the same, with food companies making record profits. A recent University of Nebraska study shows ethanol reduces greenhouse gas emissions by 51%. All these items are about market access. And remember, we are mandated out of 90% of the fuel market. And those that have 90% of the fuel market don't want to give it up. Why should we want market access above 10%? Because today the ethanol industry provides 46,000 jobs directly and 238,000 jobs in all sectors. Every billion gallons of production creates 10 to 20,000 new green jobs. We can use our state's labor, infrastructure, land, and crops rather than importing all of our state's fuel, where incidentally 70% of our state's fuel comes from the tar sands of Alberta, where, guess what, it is highly intensive in water usage and environmentally unfriendly as it gets. Some people complain about ethanol subsidies, that it should stand on its own. The facts of the matter are, without the Minnesota producer payment, this industry would have never gotten started and financed and would not have revitalized rural parts of our state. According to the Minnesota State Auditor's Office, every dollar spent has returned $16 to the state. The federal tax credit in 2007 amounted to $3.3 billion, but the ethanol industry returned $4.6 billion in tax revenue, and I can personally attest as a farmer, and happily so, to reduce payments to farmers to the tune of $8 billion. I would say the return on investment has been extraordinary. A final statement on subsidies. A couple of weeks ago, WCCO-TV said, today E85 sells for $1.45 a gallon. Without subsidies, it would sell for $2.23 a gallon. Today, a gallon of gasoline sells for $1.85 a gallon. Without subsidies, that same gallon would cost $5.28 a gallon. My question is, without subsidies, which fuel would the Minnesota consumer and the national consumer pick? It is pretty easy to figure out. Another reason for increased market access is national security. Today, if ethanol was a foreign import, ethanol would be in second place, behind only Canada and ahead of Saudi Arabia. Personally, I don't mind being behind Canada. They are a friend and an ally. But I am very happy to be ahead of Saudi Arabia. I think it should be a goal of ours as a nation to stop importing fuel and oil from countries that hate us. According to the Department of Energy, ethanol saved American consumers approximately 15% of their total gas bill, or around 35 cents a gallon. I have a report from ExxonMobil. They are the leading U.S. oil company in the nation. And in the second and third quarters combined, they had a record profit of $26.5 billion. 1% of that amount is $265 million. With that kind of money, they can do a lot of fighting to maintain 90% market share, which I believe they have done the past 12 to 18 months. Incidentally, even with their record profit, they paid a $170 million charge in interest to punitive damage for the Exxon Valdez oil spill that occurred way back in 1989. We as an industry have now formed a group called Growth Energy. We have employed former presidential candidate Wesley Clark and four-star general Wesley Clark and former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich to help us in our efforts to spread the truth about ethanol, particularly in Washington, D.C., New York, and elsewhere where we don't have a business presence. We published the brochure that I had passed out to you all, and I hope you take time to take a good look at it and to possibly log on to the website of Growth Energy. I have been privileged in my time in the ethanol industry to meet three of the major players in this industry. Two of them hail from Minnesota, Ron Fagan from Granite Falls, the Bruin brothers from Wanamingo, now based in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Dave Vandegrin of Colwich, Kansas. All have been instrumental in promoting and helping us to get the truth out about our industry. The ethanol industry has deep roots in this state, from the farmers who initially invested, to the builders and designers that built plants, and to our elected officials who could see an opportunity and a future of increased economic activity, cleaner air, cleaner water, and increased national security. Agriculture is the backbone of our economy. Ethanol is a key component of agriculture. We can help Minnesota recover from this recession. The stakes are too high. We have to stand strong in our policies in Minnesota, and we must continue to lead the way nationally to gain access to the market beyond D10. And I would thank you once again for your time. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Committee have any questions or responses? Mr. Nelson, I was just following along in the green book that you passed out for us from Growth Energy, and there's a lot of good statistics in there, but your report was just filled with a lot more information. I wonder if you'd be able to provide the committee with a copy of your testimony.
I most certainly can. It's all handwritten, if you can read it. So.
Well, we could either scan it and then perhaps try to get that out to members.
Or certainly do that. So.
Okay. I think that would be much appreciated. I think it was full of a lot of real interesting information. Thank you.
Okay. Who would I talk to get that?
Well, we'll talk to Mr. Michaels here. He'll follow up with you.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much. Next we have Doug Albin. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, thank you. My name is Doug Albin, and I serve as president of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. I farm near Clarkfield, Minnesota, and today I sit before you as a advocate for agriculture and ultimately an advocate for the state of Minnesota. Ethanol has been a huge boon to the agriculture economy in the state of Minnesota. A lot of positives came out of it, a lot of challenges. But challenges comes out, there comes opportunities. We've done such a good job in Minnesota. We've actually come up, like Brad said, against the blend wall. We've done too well. Now we've got a great product, but we need to get it out. We need to get it out further. Today I brought in front of you, I believe it's five documents that we have to deal with. As a representative of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, a lot of what we end up having to do is we do a lot of research, not only questioning what we do ourselves, trying to make ourselves better, but we're also put in the precarious situation of having to validate reports that come out from the University of Minnesota and others. And so today I put in front of you the life cycle efficiencies from the University of Nebraska. And then there's a couple of articles that came out of a local AgriWeek newspaper, one week, criticizing ethanol from the University of Minnesota. And the other one is reporting on the credibility of the Nebraska study. We believe in ethanol. We believe it's a great product. Unfortunately, the news media grabs hold of headlines, and before they get into it and find out there's no basic research behind it, they run it up the flagpole as being the miracle cure. They want to destroy ethanol. They want to destroy everything rural Minnesota has done with the promise of possibilities coming down the road. So these are the realities that we have to deal with in our organization. The other sheet of paper that I handed out is a bar chart. It's a little thing, but it shows the increase in corn production for the state of Minnesota and what the ethanol industry has meant to us. Livestock as a percentage of corn consumption stays constant, and so do our exports. We're still exporting 40 to 50% of our corn out of this state that is not value added. Ethanol is a bright spot on that. It adds value to our corn and value to our rural communities. One of the other things that we need to take and touch on is corn growers' continued support for the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota is there to challenge, but also to help us. We do have friends over there, and we do support them. We support them with basic research, research dollars, and partnering with others, because we eventually want to arrive at what is the best for Minnesota. I firmly believe that ethanol and the expansion of the ethanol market is the best way for Minnesota.
Okay, Mr. Albin, is that the end of your testimony?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee? And I just want to say, as we deal with some issues where there are people on different sides of most issues we talk about here at the Capitol, that we have to make sure that we're not painting with broad strokes, folks that, for example, University of Minnesota, I've heard a lot of people displeased with a recent study that came out, and you referenced that. But we have to make sure that because people may disagree with one particular study doesn't mean we need to demonize the university. And I'm not suggesting you're doing that, sir, but I think in order to keep our eye on the topics and research-based information, that we really need to keep in mind the good research that does come out of the university, whether or not we agree with every particular study. Senator Dill.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't see the University of Minnesota on the witness list here. Were they invited to participate in this meeting?
That's a good question, Senator Dill. Just a moment.
Madam Chair, if I could address that comment. I, for one, actually enjoy the challenges and people questioning exactly what we're doing out here, because it does give us a chance to communicate what we are doing, and it does make us better. I don't appreciate not having all the facts presented, and that's what we need to do. It may not necessarily be so much the research as it is the dissemination of the information from that research and picking bits and pieces that are applicable to making a headline. And that does a disservice to the University of Minnesota and does a disservice to the farmers of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to our world, Mr. Albin.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just kind of a comment for the members, when we're looking at all these studies and I, too, am a strong supporter of the University of Minnesota research. But when we're looking at all these studies, we have to make sure that they're doing an apples-to-apples comparison. And I didn't read the University of Minnesota study on corn ethanol, but I did read the Star Tribune article about it. And when you got to the end of the article, they talked about how in the cellulosic ethanol, they were making the base assumption that all the electricity used in the plant and all the energy used to dry the stuff down at the end was generated on site from one of these combustion electricity makers that doesn't have any emissions. And the corn cell ethanol, they assumed that all of the power there was coming from either coal electricity or some other carbon-based fuel. So it wasn't an apples-to-apples comparison. I mean, it wasn't a fair comparison, because a huge amount of the energy used in an ethanol plant is to dry the distilled grains down to have less weight for shipping. So, you have to always kind of review these and make sure that they're talking about the same thing. And I think that's part of what the corn growers' effort today is to make sure that we're making, as a state, accurate comparison when we decide which path we take with regard to these renewable fuels. And I appreciate you being here today and making your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Scoia. And I think to Senator Dill's point about the university, I'd be happy to talk to Senator Vickerman when he returns about seeing if the university would be interested in presenting their paper, since we're having a discussion about a reaction to a study, and we haven't actually had the study presented to us. So I don't know if that's where you're going, Senator Dill, but it seems like a good suggestion.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, I think it would have been helpful to have them here today so we can kind of capture both sides of the argument and have them respond to each other and so forth.
All right. Good. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Albin.
Thank
you. Okay. Next on the agenda, Rod Jorgensen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rod Jorgensen. I'm a farmer from the Casson area. I serve on the board of directors of Alcorn Clean Fuel Cooperative in Claremont, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I would like to share with you how the state's partnership with ethanol producers sparked the beginning of an industry, what it has meant to our community and other communities in the state, and how our plant has continued to improve efficiencies over the 13 years of producing ethanol. The producer payment gave us an opportunity to build the ethanol industry in the state of Minnesota. Without it, most of the plants producing today would not have been built. This program was designed to offset the estimated cost of building a facility over a 10-year period. With the program in place, lenders were given the assurance that there would be sufficient revenue to repay the construction loan. Even with the program in place, lenders still required as much as 50% owner equity to obtain financing. Local groups had to risk their capital to start this industry that the state wanted to develop. The program was not a blank check. It required continued successful operation, or the state was off the hook for its obligation. While the state requirement was to produce 15 million of gallons per year to receive maximum payment, plants worked to pay down debt very quickly and used the state payments to reinvest in themselves. Our plant has invested $65 million over its life, creating numerous engineering and construction jobs for Minnesota businesses and trades. To give you an indication where our industry has come from, I thought it would be good to give you a snapshot of where our plant was 13 years ago and how it compares today. We started our company with 300 farmer members. We now have 515 members. Our first full year of production, we ground 3.5 million bushels of corn. Today, that number is 15 million bushels. 13 years ago, we produced ethanol and dried distillers grains. Today, we produce ethanol, dried distillers grains, carbon dioxide, and corn oil. The initial plant cost was $18 million. As I've stated, we've spent $65 million to expand our business and add emission control equipment. While increasing production, we've also become more efficient. Energy consumption was over 40,000 BTUs per gallon of ethanol produced when we started. Today, it's 31,000 BTUs per gallon. Our electrical use per gallon has been reduced by 29%. Our ethanol yield has increased from 2.6 gallons per bushel to 2.9 gallons per bushel. And while accomplishing all of this, we've continued to use less and less water for every gallon we produced. In our early years, we used 6 gallons of water for every gallon of ethanol produced, and we discharged 4 gallons. This past January, we used 2 gallons of water for every gallon of ethanol produced, and we are a zero discharge facility. While our story may somewhat differ from other ethanol producers, our plant is an example of how the industry as a whole is evolving. Finally, let me state that I empathize with the tough choices you will be making in regards to the state budget. We are in difficult times. Yet I and other stakeholders feel that the past commitments made by the state need to be fulfilled too. Several groups of farmers around the state took the state's word, made the investment, risked the capital, pledged their commodities, and did everything that the state asked them to do. We are asking that the state meet its obligation just as we have. The producer payments are a unique animal. When the commitments have been filled, they're done. End of program, end of state expenditures. While I'm sure there are many ideas of projects that could bring jobs and economic activity to the state, we respectfully ask that you commit to finishing this one before you start others. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jorgensen. Any questions or comments from the committee? Okay, thank you. Next, we have Steve Anderson. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Anderson, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Steve Anderson. I'm president, board of directors up at the Little Falls Ethanol Plant for quite some time. And I'd just like thank you for this opportunity to testify. Minnesota has always been the front runner and led the most progressive clean fuel program in the country. Since the early 1990s, the 10% ethanol blend mandate in the Twin Cities metro area expanded into a statewide policy, ensuring that the majority of gasoline be blended with ethanol was to provide cleaner air for all of us to breathe and reduce our CO2 emissions. The program also allowed us to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. The 20-cent ethanol producer payment legislation has provided farmers the security required by the lenders to invest in farmer-owned ethanol facilities. This program also allowed us financial advantage to compete in the marketplace, which was owned largely by agribusiness. Unique aspects of the ethanol industry made these incentive payments necessary for us. Other goals of the program included a market for the state's largest crop, to develop ethanol production facilities in the state, to ensure farmers greater returns for their crops and meet the EPA standards for carbon monoxide. Today, the state's industry capacity can provide over 850 million gallons of ethanol and has a total impact of nearly $5 billion and has created over 18,000 jobs in rural America, which has also bolstered the takes of the state's tax base, which what it was designed to do. And to reiterate some of what our former advocates have said, the ethanol industry is hurting, primarily from the markets and last year the volatility in the markets on both the corn market and the financial side of things. And we are bound by high-priced corn and low-priced ethanol. Since last quarter last year, we have, most of us, experienced pretty much negative cash flow. And the ethanol producer payments have been helping us along for, as, you know, to help us cash flow our organizations. It's been difficult for all of us, but we think we can manage this storm like we've managed the other ones that we've gone through. We forecast that after March, the commodity prices will come down, the price of corn, and being that the price of crude has come down substantially from its highs last summer, we think we can cash flow into these difficult times. So I would promote that you maintain the producer payment program for all of us. I know we're getting to the tail end of the program, but it's still a commitment and that we have committed to, and we always looked as a state as a partner for us. Little Falls plant is a little different from the others in that we haven't expanded in volume we've expanded in technology. And we invested $18 million in a gasification unit and to help reduce our independence of natural gas and fossil fuels. We're also in partnership with Central Minnesota Cellulosic Ethanol Partners, and we are going to be designing and building the first commercial cellulosic plant in the state of Minnesota of 10 million gallon capacity. We're fortunate to receive $100,000 from the ORI grant and also from the ExGen grant of $910,000. So we look forward to this opportunity with the state again and would hope that you again continue your support with our industry. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Anderson. I want to personally, the Little Falls Ethanol Plant is in my district, and I want to personally thank you for the work that you've done. And your wife does a great job, too, in promoting the central Minnesota area. A question I have is how many jobs do you have at the plant at this current time?
On staff, we have 30.
Pardon me?
We have 30 jobs.
30 jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, and I will tell you that members and in the audience that to me, if you ask any, I think if you ask people right now, what is the most important thing that you can have, and it's a job. I've got Larson Boat Works in my district, and there's been over 200 layoffs, and I will tell you that people are really hurting. Mm-hmm. So to be able to have these jobs in central Minnesota at the ethanol plant is a good thing. And I will tell you that every time I come down here, I come by the plant, and the steam is rolling out of there, and I feel really good about it, but I feel really bad. And the reason I feel real bad, and I'm going to tell you because I have the floor, but back when I was milking cows, I had somebody that came to me and said, well, Paul, we'd like to have you invest in the ethanol plant. And so I bought 10,000 shares at $1.50 a share. And then shortly after that, I got elected, and I was green, kind of like Senator Scogin is now. And
that's for different reasons.
Okay. But I bought $15,000 worth of shares and didn't realize that I could recuse myself from voting on. Nobody told me that. And so I was all worried that it would be a conflict of interest. So I immediately called up there, and I sold my shares that I had been holding for 2.5 years for exactly what I paid for them, for $1.50 a share. And I never received a payment of any kind. So, but I'm just glad that I actually feel like I was a part of getting the project off the ground. And it's just been a good thing for our area. I sure wish I had some shares in there, I can tell you that. But and I will tell you that it's helped the surrounding areas to bring the price of corn up, which helps the farmers, too. They really didn't have, the only outlet they had was in St. Cloud at Golden Plump. So this really makes it competitive so that they can get the farmers to have a good price for their products. So thank you, Mr. Anderson. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for those comments.
Thank you, Senator Coring. Senator Scogin.
Just to that point real quick.
Okay.
Senator Coring, thank you, Manager. Senator Coring, I have to tell you, in today's economy, getting your principal back sometimes is...
I know. That's probably, I can look at it a good way.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just curious, as you move towards cellulosic, does that then, are you going to do less corn base?
No, we're going to maintain the current starch plant and build the cellulosic adjacent to our starch plant, and the cellulosic plant will be 10 million gallons, the design capacity, with designing to up to 50 million gallons.
Madam Chair, a follow-up then, and that will employ how many more?
About 20 more jobs.
Very good. Senator Langseth, do you have questions?
Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson, you know, we hear the argument about food versus fuel. What percentage of the feed value for livestock is left after the ethanol process takes place?
Typical bushel of corn is 56 pounds, And what's left is 17 pounds is the per bushel of corn for livestock feed. So you're almost putting back a third back into the livestock sector. And we sell that to the local dairy farmers within our region. And also we have wet distillers that we don't dry, and we sell to our the beef producers within the local region. So when you hear the negativism about corn, you never hear the part that almost 30% or 17% of a bushel goes back into feeding the cattle and livestock.
I've noticed that when the arguments are being made.
We also supply the chicken industry, too, with dry distillers, the poultry industry also. So there's the food is, the corn is not the issue. It's the negativism from others that don't want to see us succeed.
Senator Scoy and then Senator Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the witness. You're shipping some of your distiller's grain out wet. You know, I've always thought if we could expand the animal industry around these plants, it would be a really good thing so you didn't have to dry it down. Do you have a feel for what kind of radius it's efficient to ship the wet distiller's grain?
Yeah, typically we ship within 70-mile radius.
70 miles. Huh?
And with the Morris plant has just recently shut down, we've taken on a lot of those contracts now to fill those markets. So we also are helping those markets out, which goes farther. What's interesting and what's good about selling wet versus dry is the dryer takes about 30% of the natural mm-hmm. gas usage for the plant. So when we shut the dryer down, we mm-hmm. we make better use of the facility.
Very good.
Okay, Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson, if you had an investor that had put $15,000 into your plant at the beginning, what would be the value of the dividends and that he would have gotten up to this date, and what would his shares be worth today?
Okay.
I don't want to know the answer to that question.
I can give you the gross amount. I believe we've paid out over $17 million in dividends, and I believe the outstanding is $4.55 of total is what we've paid out. There's $2 remaining on each share right now. That's unallocated.
So you Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson, so you paid out $4.50 per share.
That's the total. The total amount we've paid is $17 million and 17.4 something since we've been operating.
So did a share in the beginning cost a buck and a half?
Buck and a half. They were trading as much as seven, okay. And now they're trading about 3.5.
Because so if a person had 10,000 shares to start with and you've paid back $4.50 a share, you would have gotten $45,000, huh?
Well, we've done better than Wall Street. Thanks a lot.
Has somebody got a million?
Well, we're all sorry, Mr. Senator Coring.
Well, that's the, Madam Chair, that's the cost of public service.
Your constituents will be proud. Any other questions for Mr. Anderson? Okay. Thank you
very much.
We're finished with the section then that deals with the ethanol industry and clean fuels. And we'll move on to the governor's budget recommendations. This is a continuation from the Department of Ag. And do we have Joe Martin, Steve Ernst, and Quinn Cheney here? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Martin. I serve as the Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And as a follow-up to our last hearing, we talked about the pesticide and fertilizer management unit. Today I'm here just to provide a brief on the agenda, background information, but just a little bit about the dairy and food division and the one change item in your packets. Madam Chair, members, I guess I'd just start by saying that the Dairy and Food Division is primarily our largest regulatory division, dealing with several high-profile issues, as you've been hearing about. This is the division where our food inspectors are housed, where our dairy farm inspectors are housed. We have primary work in this area is inspecting dairy farms, food processing plants, grocery stores, and then tracking foodborne illnesses, as was typified in this last circumstance with peanut butter. The one thing I'll start by saying is that this is one of our core functions we believe very strongly, and accordingly, this is a division that we have held harmless in terms of the budget. There is no budget reductions being sought in this division, nor has there been for several years. We've taken this responsibility probably the greatest in the department. One change item that you will see affecting this division deals with reinspections, and we are seeking a fee increase for reinspection activities. Reinspections occur when our inspectors are at a facility and we find problems and we need to go back. And the division's been funded, and I should take a step back in terms of funding for the division. The division is funded with both general fund and fees. It's primarily funded with general fund, but it's a mix and match. We do charge fees for reinspections right now. This proposal would increase those reinspection fees. In terms of the food handlers, this would be the food processing facilities or grocery stores where we may find problems. The fee increase would be, and it's broken out in terms of sales. If for facilities that are under $1 million in gross sales, they would see a $75 increase. The current fee is $75 and be going to $150. For those facilities over $1 million in gross sales, they would see a $100 increase from $100 to $200. The other part of that is dairy farm reinspections. We conduct over 10,000 dairy farm inspections every year. If you're a grade A dairy farm, we inspect twice a year. If you're grade B, once per year. Last year we had a case, I think we had to reinspect about 600. So it's not a big number of dairy farms that we have to go back and reinspect, but there are some, and we're proposing a $55 increase for a dairy farm reinspection. That the current fee is $45 and it'll be going to $100. So with that, I'll conclude and take questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, I just have a general question here. On all this inspecting of various food processing and meat processing plants and dairy farms and so forth, are all those inspections generally made unannounced, or does the proprietor of the business have some notion as to when you're going to show up?
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, I don't know the exact answer to that question. I think it may be a combination of both. But I can get back to you on that and ask our director of our division of how those are communicated.
Madam.
So, Madam Chair, members, I just thinking about this dog and cat bill we've had. There's some people that think there should be unannounced inspections, but that's kind of hard to do because a lot of dog and cat people aren't at home during the day. They're working in town, whereas in the case of a dairy farm, there's somebody there every 12 hours for sure. But to do a random or annual or biannual unannounced inspection to a dog facility is probably not going to work out too well most of the time because it may be hard to find people at home.
Madam Chair, Dave Reed, one of our managers of the division, just joined me, and he informed me that our inspections are unannounced.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair. All inspections for everything you do, all types of?
Madam Chair. Senator,
yes.
Basically, we do unannounced inspections. There are instances where we have difficulty getting a hold of the owner or operator of the facility. It may be a seasonal business or something of that nature. In those cases, we would try to make a contact, but by and large, our inspections are unannounced.
Okay, thank you. Sandra Coring, then Senator Murphy.
And Madam Chair, I was just going to say that when I was dairy farming, the inspector would come about every 6 months, so there was about a 30, kind of knew that the inspector would be there within probably, like if they inspected in July, they probably would be there about January. And, you know, you never knew when they were going to come, but at least you knew every 6 months that you were going to be inspected. So is that about right? Or?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Senator Murphy.
thank you, Madam Chair. My question is more along the fiscal lines. Now, this $55 increase, is that enough to sustain the program, or is there going to have to be increases from the general fund as well?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Martin.
I would be uncomfortable in saying that this would cover all of the costs of reinspections. I think it gets close, but I think it's safe to say that there will be times where we'll need to transfer general fund money to cover the full cost of reinspections.
And Madam Chairman, are you talking
Senator
about
Murphy.
You're talking about the fund of money inside of the Ag Department currently?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
There's a general fund appropriation to the Dairy and Food Division which covers those.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Martin, I had one question. You were talking about sort of a two-tiered increase based on less than a million or greater than a million. I didn't hear any distinction with dairy. Is there that same split with the dairy? You were talking about, did you say a $45 increase there? Is there a split based on production there as well?
Madam Chair, no, there is no distinction between amount of sales. It would be a flat rate.
Okay, I'm confused then as to why you have a two-tiered system then for over a million or under a million, going from 75 to 150 or 100 to 200 in one area, but it's a flat rate in others.
Madam Chair, best answer I could give you is that's been historically what the statute has laid out.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
For the record, my name is Dave Reed. The last name is R-E-A-D, and I'm with the Dairy and Food Inspection Division of Agriculture. These fees are charged through different areas of the statute. The food licensing fees are based on the gross sales of the companies that are licensed. And so there's a lower rate for the reinspection fee for companies that make under a certain amount, and it's a higher rate for those that make or report over that in gross sales. In dairy, we don't make that distinction because through the light, it's a permit fee. It's not actually a license fee that they're issuing for the dairy farms.
So whether they're a very small dairy or a really large one, it's the same fee.
I believe that's correct. Chair, I believe that's correct.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Coring.
I would just reiterate what I said the other day, that this increase in the fee kind of concerns me, and I just told my good friend here, Senator Murphy, that, you know, if you're milking 500 cows, $100 for the reinspection fee is not that big a deal, but I think I have 300-plus dairy farms just in Morrison County alone, and a lot of them are small operations, you know, 30, 40 cows. And at $9.50 or $10 milk right now, that's 1,000 pounds of milk just to pay for that $100 reinspection fee. And I don't know, it really kind of, it worries me, it bothers me, you know. And somebody could make the comment, well, make sure your farm is clean. Well, I think farmers do make the effort, but there might be something. I can remember when I was milking, I got a check because I didn't have a non-siphoning valve on my stock tank. That didn't warrant a reinspection. I don't believe that does. But, you know, but if there's too many things that add up, then it could warrant a reinspection. So it was just a comment that I'm not comfortable with that, and I'm going to try to be working with the chair and this committee to see if we can what I can do about this increase in fees.
Thank you, Senator Cory. Hey, Mr. Martin, anything else?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And Madam Chair,
yes.
No more questions for Mr. Martin, but you know what? Could I indulge you to let me ask one more question to Mr. Jorgensen? I just thought of a very important question that I'd like to have an answer to.
Mr. Jorgensen, if you'd return to the stand, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate it. My question is we heard from Mr. Anderson, and the Little Falls ethanol plant has done well. I mean, but they're struggling now. And I guess my question is what's the health of all the other ethanol plants in Minnesota? Are they doing okay? I guess I'm kind of wondering. I don't want people to get the wrong impression that we're. Well, anyway, what's the health of the other ethanol plants in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Senators, I can give you, I know best the plant that I represent, and I'm closer to a couple other plants, so I don't know, just like any other businesses, plants are, on different levels, but I can tell you, it was mentioned, what the share price was, and I think the Little Falls plant is a little bit of an anomaly. Our plant has about a quarter of a million shares that are up for sale now that no one really seems to be interested in taking, and share prices, if I had to guess, you could get shares bought for a dollar or less. I think that's pretty typical, and the Winthrop plant, Heartland Corn Products, actually has auctions, and I know that some of those shares have gone for in that range or less, and it's a reflection of the profitability of the plants. And right now, the last several months, when we've seen this, when we entered into this recession, the price of fuel has come down. And as one of the first, Brad mentioned early on, we're hitting that blend wall, and there's actually a surplus of ethanol because of what can be put into motor fuels, because actually motor fuel consumption is going down, and that wasn't anticipated a year or so ago. So for some plants, it's going to be pretty tenuous because ethanol prices are down, and we're, fortunate if a plant can break even right now.
And one, can I ask another question, Madam Chair?
Last one, Senator.
Okay. Madam Chair, Mr. Jorgensen, how many jobs are there at your plant? And, I think some people are critical of the subsidy that we give to ethanol. And the subsidy, if you look at the whole scheme of things, it's very, very minimal. And I guess if you look at the jobs, like in Little Falls, minimum wage jobs. These are good jobs, and the income taxes that are being paid on them. I guess I'd like to see some numbers on that. But how many jobs have you got at your plant there?
Madam Chair, Senators, we have about 32 jobs, the last I was aware of, and they range from people in the plant up to our general manager. But it's a skilled workforce, so we don't. We pay a good living salary for even the people that come here. And what's interesting, too, is our plant manager, every plant manager we've had, not our general manager, but our plant manager, has worked themselves up through our company. And so in the ethanol industry, if you just go there and start out, if you work hard, you're going to have an opportunity to come up through the ranks, and with the industry statewide, you can find jobs all over the state. And it just made me think of your comment about the recent federal stimulus bill and what a created job is going to cost. I've heard upwards of a quarter of a million or $250,000 for a job. And so I agree that it's very important to keep the jobs that we have, too.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Steve Ernest Quinchaney.
Please. Madam Chair, Quinn Cheney, the Policy Director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm going to ask Geir Friso to talk about the invasive species change item.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, my name is Geir Friso. I'm the Director of the Plant Protection Division. The Quinn asked me just to go very briefly through the division, and then I'll talk about the change items. And in brief, our division is charged with trying to protect agriculture and the environment from plant pests and pathogens. Then we also provide certification services for a variety of crops. Some of the programs that we provide a seed inspection service that ensures that farmers are buying quality seed, that it meets certain germination requirements, that it's not contaminated. Provide fruit and vegetable inspection services, grading services. We do export certification services. Just listening to the earlier discussion, it was interesting in that the number of export certificates that the department has issued is almost doubled in the last year, and a lot of that is the result of the dry distiller grain coming from the ethanol market. So that's been an interesting byproduct that we've noticed. That, together with the low dollar, I think, we've seen a huge increase in Minnesota exports internationally. Provide a seed potato inspection service that ensures that potato growers are buying potatoes that are free of viruses and diseases. We have a very small apiary inspection program. Many Minnesota beekeepers migrate their bees to California and Louisiana primarily for pollination services, and we ensure that those beehives are free of various pests. We have a very vigorous nursery inspection program that ensures that the quality of those stocks and also that there's no invasive species being brought in. We provide a commercial potato inspection grading program that's really just a fee-for-service type of program. We have a small noxious weed program primarily to help with training counties. One of our larger general feed programs is our gypsy moth, and you may know that gypsy moth is kind of knocking at the door here in Minnesota. We set about 20,000 traps every year in Minnesota, and in the coming year we've got almost 100,000 acres of treatments that we'll be doing on the North Shore to try and keep this pest at bay. The general funds that we expend are leverage almost $2.5 million in federal funds, so it's I think it's a good deal for the buck. And then for our invasive species program, we have a variety of plant pests that we deal with. The potato cyst nematode, we get about $450,000 in federal support for that. That's an exotic nematode that does not exist in Minnesota, and we're trying to keep it out. Emerald ash borer, cereal cyst nematode, golden nematode, Cyrex wood wasp, and general survey, and all of which is we get about $820,000 in USDA support for those programs. I always like to talk about one example of a good pathway. There's all sorts of pathways for invasive pests, but one of the more interesting one is we had almost 2 million geranium plants came to Minnesota from Kenya, and this is part of the global market. Things come from all over the world, and these geraniums came to Minnesota. They carried a bacteria called Ralstonia, and Ralstonia doesn't exist in North America. And you may not care about geraniums, and that's fine, but Ralstonia is a very serious potato disease. And had that disease gotten into the water of Minnesota, it could have created havoc for potato growers, as it is doing in Europe right now. So we found 29 nurseries in Minnesota that were contaminated with this disease, and we took action to eliminate it. And we even got to have a few big bonfires. I know we're not as glamorous as the animal guys that burn sheep and stuff, but we get to burn plants from time to time. So we appreciate doing that. Then on to a couple of change items. One is our small program that we have is the wolf elk depredation. And this is a program that was set in place to compensate farmers and livestock producers from damage caused by wolf and elk. Wolf damage, it kind of goes up and down every year, and is fairly stable, and it's always has been a very well-run program. It's a pass-through program. There's $100,000, and it's based on the valuation is from a cooperative extension provides us, and then conservation officers verify the damage. What's happened recently is there's been an expanding elk herd up in the far northwest part of the state, and there's also an elk herd that's migrating down across the Canadian border. Well, you can imagine the kind of damage that elk can cause if they get into sunflower or soybeans or oats or something like that. So we've had some enormous claims against that fund, which essentially drained the full account just a few months into the program. So we are sitting on right now about close to $40,000 of claims that we can't pay because of this. We've had a number of meetings with some of our sister agencies and USDA Wildlife Services and some of the producers, and so we're proposing to split the two funds, the wolf and elk, in half because the elk is kind of unfairly impacting the wolf part, and then we're asking for an additional $50,000 to fund the two programs, so $75,000 each. And then the other change item is reducing or eliminating the plant pest survey. This is a program that's, I think, served farmers and agriculture well over many, many years. It's been in place for a long time. The difficulty has been with reduced budgets, just looking at priorities, and we felt that this was one service. Although it's very valuable from a historical perspective, it provides very good information to the university. But when it comes to real day-to-day decision-making by farmers, those decisions are probably more readily obtained from crop consultants or from farmers looking at their fields themselves because there is such variation from field to field. So this is one of the programs, and I don't like to see any of my programs going away, but this is one of the difficult decisions we made. Was to suggest that this would be one of our reductions.
Mr. Friso, on that, the plant pest survey, then is that something you'd recommend bringing back again at another time when the state may be in more prosperous years, or is it just going to be a permanent reduction?
Madam Chair, I would like to see some program coming back similar to it. I don't know if I would structure it exactly the same as it is now. I think I would structure it more so it's supporting some of our export programs because other countries want verification of the absence of certain pests. So, and also things like BT-ready corn has eliminated the need for surveying for things like a European corn borer, so that data really doesn't provide much value anymore. So I'd like to see it come back, but in a different format.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Friso? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Cheney, you have someone next?
Yep. Okay. Madam Chair, thank you very much. I now would like Peter Sheffert, who's the head of our Ag Development and Financial Assistance Division, to talk a little bit about the change item in their division.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Sheffert. I'm in my 10th month as a member of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I work as Division Director for the Ag Development and Financial Assistance Division, and it is a pleasure to join you here today. And I want to visit about some of our recommended changes. Our division overall, in brief summary, works in a lot of the non-regulatory areas of the Department of Agriculture. We have some groups that work with environmental stewardship challenges and land challenges. In particular, some of the work we're doing there is in ag drainage, cover crops, managed grazing, help with conservation programs in regards to information and policy development, and then land protection and preservation. We also have a section that deals with some of the ag diversification and alternative methods of pest management and control with invasive species. And some of the work they do includes the work we have in sustainable agriculture, organic agriculture, biocontrol and integrated pest management, and then urban pest management. We also have an insect and plant pathology containment facility in conjunction with the University of Minnesota. Finally, we do work in financial assistance. This is the old Rural Finance Authority division and the authority that they have. And the loans that are offered to the Rural Finance Authority are aimed generally at beginning farmers, livestock producers, and farmers facing financial adversity. But we've also involved in a number of loans over the years. That also program also includes the Ag BMP loan program, best management program, that works with a lot of local units of government. And finally, the sustainable ag loans and last year's livestock investment grant program was worked in partnership with the other another division for that. The current budget crisis that we have reinforces the need to continually evaluate how we best use the public's trust and dollars to carry out the mission. And I want to thank the committee for their support in years past for some of the things that we've done. But our priorities need to be the safety of our food and food systems, the conservation, maintenance, and improvement of our environment, and the economic vitality of the agriculture economy. And to meet those limited and those needs in a time of limited resources, we had to prioritize. Today, I'd like to talk about some reductions that we have, and they include the reduction in research and education in the control and management of pests once they reach the state. We work in partnership with Gears Division around, he tries to keep the pests out, and once they get in, we're looking at some of the biocontrol and integrated pest management ways of managing that. We are looking at elimination of programs that help urban residents manage and control pests, and finally, a reduction in the amount of sustainable ag grants that have helped pilot the projects in sustainable and organic programs, as well as a little bit of biomass production. The first one, reduction to the integrated pest management biological control programs. It's a $320,000 cut. These programs are about managing established and economically important insect pests, diseases, and weeds. We do that through two ways in Minnesota, biological control strategies that we've been working on for the leafy spurge, spotted knapweed, and soybean aphid. We also have integrated pest management strategies for the Japanese beetle, orchard pests and diseases, and weeds in pastures and natural areas. The reduction in the biological control efforts will mean the elimination of work on some of the leafy spurge, spotted knapweed, thistle, common tansy, and garlic mustard, and some of this is done in cooperation with the Department of Natural Resources, as well as a partnership with the University of Minnesota on soybean aphid control bioagents. The reduction in the integrated pest management efforts will eliminate the technical assistance and scouting currently done for apple and strawberry growers. Small fruit and vegetable integrated pest management projects that we've helped support in the past we will not do anymore. And then training and technical assistance to county ag inspectors on weed management, biocontrol, and weed mapping strategies. Finally, the reduction will also eliminate the help and support that we've provided to other divisions in the Department of Agriculture as well as some other agencies on specialized and unique insect identification problems and then training of staff on insect identification. The next program is the elimination of the Urban Pest Management Program. This is a $101,000. The elimination of this program will result in the loss of a greenhouse space for rearing biocontrol agents for many of the above programs that we've talked about. It will also eliminate community outreach to master gardeners, elementary and high school students, and non-farm citizens for education on pests and appropriate pest reducing options for the control of insects and pests in the landscape within the urban areas. At this particular time, urban pests in a time of an economic upswing is a great outreach that we can do and what we've done in the past, but in reality is probably not something we can maintain in this economic environment. The last reduction that we have is in the sustainable ag grant programs. We're suggesting a $100,000 cut in this area. The total appropriation in past years has been $160,000 per year. Of that, minimum of $140,000 is used for sustainable demonstration grants. The committee is actually meeting today for this year's grants to determine what will be given out. And up to $20,000 is used for outreach of those materials and what happens out of those pilot programs. The reduction in the number of grants, we average each year 12 to 15 grants. That will go down to 3 to 5 grants. The grant is eligible, a grantee, for up to $25,000. On the average, though, it is only about $10,000. We encourage medium-sized grants that way to spread the money out further. These grants have provided significant support to Minnesotans who are examining new methods of sustainable and organic agriculture production, as well as ways to reduce energy consumption. At this time, as we look at the changes that have happened over time, interest is peaking in the local foods projects, particularly with fruits and vegetables, high tunnel season extension, managed rotational grazing, specialty hog production, and alternative crops. And those are some of the things that are coming out today. We would just do those in a lesser number. Finally, while all the work we do is important, we have to make some tough decisions in choosing which programs we can be most effective with these budget cuts. And because of the large number of partners involved in these programs, we hope that our partners in many of these projects will continue to help support those. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Any questions?
Well, I have to say, Mr. Shepherd, I'm really disappointed to hear about a lot of those cuts because I think as we have been, it's been explained to us in the past that organics as an industry and a segment of the agricultural community and state is really growing. And I think at 20% a year, is that right, Mr. Peterson, about that amount? And in my area of the world, we have hundreds of small organics farms, and this is an industry I think that is up and coming. It's not a niche industry as people had viewed it, 10 years ago. It's alive and well and growing, and to pull out all of the sustainable ag grants and the outreach to the public and the organics community, it's just really disappointing. Here's an industry that's really growing and thriving, and we're pulling out support. And then I have to say, as a master gardener, that I'm not happy to hear that the support for the Master Gardeners program is going away as well. That is one way that the state is able to deliver a lot of public education through horticulture in the urban communities, but in the rural communities as well. And we save the public thousands or millions of dollars, I guess, across the state when we're helping with backyard landscaping advice and dealing with pest management and diseases of lawns and home fruits and all of that sort of thing. So it's an area that's really going to be affecting a lot of families in cities across the state. So I'm really disappointed to hear about these cuts. Any other comments from the committee? Okay. Well, thank you very much. Ms.
Cheney. Thank you, Madam Chair. Next, I'd like to bring Kurt Markham, who's head of our Agricultural Marketing Services Division.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kurt Markham, and for the last 8 years, I've been Director of Ag Marketing Services. And Ag Marketing Services, or AMS, is modeled similarly to the federal USDA AMS program, if you've ever been on the USDA website. I'll give a brief funding description and activity and then go to the budget changes. Currently, there is a mix of funding sources for AMS. About 45% is from general fund, about 45% is from dedicated accounts, fees, and about 10% of our funds are from grants, principally from the federal area and miscellaneous. Right now, salary represents about 62% of the cost, and operating costs are about 34%. To give you a brief overview of the division, really what marketing is the facilitation for our Minnesota agricultural producers. We have a number of creative staff that work on marketing activities and services, and I'll describe 5 core areas. We have commodity council oversight of 12 commodity councils. We have a licensing and bonding program that ensures that people who buy and store grain and wholesale produce are licensed and bonded. We have a Minnesota Grown program. It's a mature program, but it grows about 10% every year. We have over 950 producers who are licensed, and in this catalog, about three-quarters of them have listed their ad. It's also the agency's number one website with over 1 million visits a year. The next core service area is our market and business development, and this is an area that develops and expands markets for existing products from Minnesota agriculture and delivers some marketing programs. Then we have a promotion of global markets. This is 2.5 FTEs. We work closely with the small and medium-sized Minnesota companies to promote their products globally. We leverage our dollars with USDA utilizing four of the Foreign Ag Service market access providers, and they are Food Export Midwest, the U.S. Dairy Council, the U.S. Grains Council, and U.S. Meat Export. And this last year, exports, agricultural exports, are up substantially. An example would be in Grains Council, the distiller's grains has doubled to about 4.5 million metric tons, and that's about 20% of the total distiller's grains in this country. As Geer mentioned, export certificates are up. The change item that I would like to touch on is we have a reduction of FTE in the business development program and also a reduction in promotional materials. The other change item, as far as Ag 21, I would prefer that Kurt Zimmerman, our livestock supervisor, talk about that later. Are there any questions?
Questions for Mr. Markham? Well, Mr. Markham, I'll just make one comment relative to the comments I just made for Mr. Friso. And that is, you said that your most successful website is the Minnesota Grown website?
Yes.
And there again, I think it underscores my previous point that the public is very interested in small and medium-sized farms, organic producers, and Minnesota Grown products. And if, you know, do the marketing people talk to the ag development people? I mean, it seems like you're expressing a tremendous amount of success in an area that's being cut in another area.
The Minnesota Grown program actually received an increase last year to $186,000. Part of the Minnesota Grown producers is in promoting the meat, livestock, and organic producers. They work together on the domestic trade shows here in the Midwest, principally Minnesota.
Yes, and I think it's a terrific program, and thank you very much for the work that you do to help that. But my point is, you know, one department is really supporting and uplifting this direction, and another department is discontinuing their sustainable ag grants and support. It seems to be two opposing actions.
Madam Chair, the Minnesota Grown program encompasses all small producers and is really promoting the Minnesota brand that we have in all the livestock and principally the crop areas. And it really covers some of the areas such as blueberries where there might not be a producer checkoff. It doesn't, the core farm program commodity areas are not a component of the Minnesota Grown. Those are more a component of the Global Export Development Program.
I understand that. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ms. Cheney.
If I could just add one thing. The sustainable, we're actually not proposing to make any cuts to the organic program. And as Mr. Markham said, we did receive new funding last year for the Minnesota Grown program, and we are not proposing to make any cuts in that area. The only reduction is within the sustainable ag area. And part of the reason that that cut was being made is we actually did not receive enough applications to administer all of the money that we received during the last budget year. So we're not reducing in the organic area, only in the sustainable area.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting fact to know, Ms. Cheney, thank you, that there were not even enough applicants to use the amount of funds that have been appropriated. That's very
interesting. That is my understanding.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Markham.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Cheney.
I feel like a bit of a cruise director, Madam Chair. next, we have Steve Ernest, our finance director, and he's going to talk a little bit about the ethanol producer payment program.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ernest. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve Ernest, financial management director at the Department of Agriculture. What I wanted to do today is just to give you an overview of where we're at with the ethanol producer payments. There's a one-page handout that summarizes some of the past years and how the program is winding down. The base appropriation for this purpose is $15.168 million. The appropriation is primarily for ethanol producer payments, but it is open to other value-added and rural economic infrastructure as the ethanol program winds down. As you can see on the chart, the first year of the biennium, 2008, we needed almost all the payments, all the appropriation for regular producer payments. We had just a little bit left over for deficiency payments. And this year, we're about half and half, $7.5 million for each regular payments and deficiency payments. We have eight plants that are currently still receiving regular payments this fiscal year, 2009. We had a slight one-time cut of $310,000 this year to help with the budget last time, and that resulted in a little less money going out in deficiency payments, or will result at the end of the year when we get to the deficiency payments. In fiscal year 10 and 11, if we have the same base appropriation, we would need $1.5 million for our remaining two plants that are left, will be left in the program with regular producer payments. And then the statute does sunset the program at the end of fiscal year 2010. Based on the amount of deficiency amounts that we've calculated, that we did not pay the full 20 cents per gallon in past years, it'll take us all of fiscal year 2011 and most of fiscal year 2012's appropriation, that's the next biennium after this one though, to make all those deficiency payments. We did have a couple plants fall off the deficiency payments, Gopher State in St. Paul and Melrose Dairy Proteins in Melrose, due to the fact that they are no longer producing ethanol and so are not eligible for the deficiency payments. And then as you can see on the bottom line, the bottom line of the top part of this page, 2012 and 2013, we would then have some money freed up from the base appropriation, $1.377 million, and then the full $15.168 million in 2013. Those amounts tie in with our next item that we have to present, the Ag 21 proposal. We're proposing moving this into a more specifically structured program. Right now the statute is not very specific on what that money would be used for. So I can take questions on this before we get to that, if there are any.
Any questions from the committee? Okay, proceed.
Finally, Madam Chair, this is Kurt Zimmerman. He's a livestock specialist in the Agriculture Marketing Division, and he's going to talk a little bit about the governor's new proposal, Ag 21.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman, and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Kurt Zimmerman. I'm a livestock development supervisor. I work in the Ag Marketing Division. Kurt Markham would be my division director. Thank you for your support of animal agriculture. I'll be talking about a livestock grant program that I was closely involved in this past year. I've been asked to talk about a new item on the in the Department of Ag budget, and that is Ag 21. Ag 21 stands for 21st Century Agriculture Reinvestment Program. The key goal of the program is to provide and encourage continued reinvestment in Minnesota's agriculture sector. The program, Ag 21, will be providing grants and loans to fund the emerging needs in agriculture in two primary areas, the support of agriculture through the Livestock Investment Grant Program that we touched on, and also bioenergy funds through the Next Generation Energy Board. Just talking briefly about the two funding areas, the Livestock Investment Grant Program and the Next Gen Energy Grant Program received one-time money in the 2008 session. Ag 21 provides ongoing funding for these two main economic sectors for Minnesota, livestock and renewable energy. Proposed funding for Ag 21 in fiscal years 2010 and 2011 would be comprised of redirected funds from the Dairy Development and Profitability Enhancement Program, $500,000 in each year. And then beginning in 2012 and 2013, additional funding would be proposed to coincide with the completion of the ethanol producer payments in each of those years. Ag 21 would be then the umbrella or a funding mechanism to support Minnesota's rural economic growth and infrastructure. The one area that I'd like to just touch on and talk to the members of the committee today would be the Ag 21 program in from the perspective of the Livestock Investment Grant Program. This was authorized with your support and assistance and a great deal of appreciation today that I can thank you for your support. Last year, we were funded in a one-time basis for a $1 million appropriation. Eligible investments that would be included, acquisition, construction, improvement of buildings and facilities, equipment for livestock housing, feeding, waste management, generally anything that hits your depreciation schedule would be included as far as an eligible item on these grants. We had all livestock species that were represented, all sizes, all shapes. We had horses, we had dairy goats, we had sheep, pork, cattle, cow, calf, finishing operations, and of course dairy. 576 producers from across Minnesota, and they represented in their applications investments of over $150 million that communities that were part of these operations received very directly. We had 38 producers we were able to fund with the $1 million. And one of the questions we asked on the application form is, will this investment encourage or result in any additional employment as a result of your investment? And we did a tally here just this week, and over 900 jobs, full and part-time, were the result of these livestock producers going through this investment process, a very real benefit and boost to the economic area. We had many successful projects. Many upgraded their manure storage facilities and helped clear up an environmental problem. Many encouraged the use of this investment to utilize better labor on the farm. All in all, it was a very positive program. One of the things that was very common throughout all of the applications, really, regardless of whether it was in the north or south or southeast or wherever, is that most of the applications talked about bringing in a new member to the of the family back to the farm. And I think that was a good thing for us to be part of. One of the things that we're very proud of with the investment grant program that would be part of Ag 21 is that we actually went out to each of the 38 people that got these grants. And Peter Shepherd's division in Ag Development and Ag Marketing's, we actually took checks in some cases, and we wanted to see firsthand what some of these projects were all about. Here's some of the comments that the people that went out to some of these places wrote in their summaries as they came back. In Maurer County, this grant recipient completed construction of a new freestall housing. There's been substantial improvement in cow comfort, already resulting in 2,000-pound herd gain. In Stearns County, the producer installed a new earth and manure storage structure, new fencing, open lots, new lighting. The farm was previously in disrepair. Changes represent a substantial reinvestment in the farm. In Houston County, we delivered a grant check to a family dairy operation. I happened to be there when the dairy inspector was on hand. They were doing the final inspection and bringing in two new robots to the milking operations in that area. The entire family was there, mom and dad and two kids that were very involved in the project. I guess in conclusion, the Ag 21 program is going to start very meagerly with very limited financing and funding. I would ask that we look at this for not maybe what it is today, which is very much in the infant stage, but to look at it for what it can be, and that is a real tremendous economic support and funding mechanism for Minnesota agriculture. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. Any questions, comments? Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Zimmerman, any first time out of the chute, any real problems with the program, with the application process, with the timelines, with the was it user-friendly?
Madam Chairman and Senator. Being a new program, I think the real challenge was just setting up the protocol and the scoring, because it's very competitive. When you have that many people applying, and we would have needed $14 or $15 million to disperse the funding, so we needed to have a fair system. So that probably was the biggest challenge. We learned some things. I believe that by doing so, we learned that we maybe don't need all of the receipts and certification that was necessary once the grants were awarded. Some of those things we did encourage maybe more work on behalf of the applicant than we would like to change and do better. I think from a standpoint of pros and cons, the pros would be very high and the cons would be very low. So as far as problems, just not having enough funding to go around to the worthy families that really were deserving that we just didn't have funding for.
Just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Scogin.
Did you get much feedback from those who weren't awarded?
I'll repeat that, please.
Did you get much feedback from those who didn't get a grant?
Absolutely. Senator, the I think disappointment. Some of the questions were why. Why did so-and-so receive this and I didn't? I think once we described the overall demand and how many people were standing in line and what type of projects were vying for these few dollars, I think most people understood. But it was a challenge to provide a fair and very transparent program, and I believe we were able to do that. But there was some disappointment, absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other comments from the committee? Ms. Cheney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I think we've covered our budget in about as much detail as we possibly can, so
okay.
Be happy to answer any other questions.
All right. Any other comments or questions from the committee? If not, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.